If we scrutinize more closely the particular acts we have above referred to, we shall discover that oftentimes they have more the appearance than the reality of virtue. But let us grant that these are real. If we do not wish to run in vain, if we do not wish to lose sight of the eternal blessedness to which God in his goodness has destined us, of what use are the natural virtues unless the gift and strength of divine grace be added? For as the nature of man, because of our common misfortune, fell into vice and dishonor, yet by the assistance of grace is lifted up and borne onward with new honor and strength, so also the virtues which are exercised not by the unaided powers of nature, but by the help of the same grace, are made more productive of a supernatural beatitude and become solid and enduring. With this opinion about natural virtues, another is intimately connected, according to which all Christian virtues are divided, as it were, into two classes, passive, as they say, and active. And they add the former were better suited for the past times, but the latter are more in keeping with the present. It is plain what is to be thought of such division of the virtues. There is not and cannot be a virtue which is really passive. St. Thomas says, virtue denotes a certain perfection of a power, but the object of a power is an act, and an act of virtue is nothing less than the good use of our free will. Divine grace, of course, helping if the act of virtue is supernatural. The master and exemplar of all sanctity is Christ, to whose rule all must conform who wish to attain to the thrones of the blessed. Now then, Christ does not change with the progress of the ages, but is yesterday and today and the same forever. To the men of all ages, the phrase is to be applied, learn of me because I am meek and humble of heart. And at all times, Christ shows himself to us becoming obedient unto death. And in every age, also the word of the apostle holds. And they that are Christ have crucified their flesh with the vices and concupiscences. Would that more would cultivate these virtues in our days, as did the holy men of bygone times. From this species of contempt of the evangelical virtues, which are wrongly called passive, it naturally follows that the mind is imbued little by little with a feeling of disdain for the religious life, and that this is common to the advocates of these new opinions we gather from certain expressions of theirs about the vows which religious orders pronounce. For, they say, such vows are altogether out of keeping with the spirit of our age, inasmuch as they narrow the limits of human liberty, are better adapted to weak minds than to strong ones, avail little for Christian perfection and the good of human society, and rather obstruct and interfere with it. But how false these assertions are is evident from the usage and teaching of the Church, which has always given the highest approval to religious life. End of quote. Again, the Church condemns in Protestantism not its affirmations, namely, that every Christian has a personal relation with our Lord, that religion is life, faith, and love, that true religion is interior in spirit and in truth, but rather its negations, to wit, that Christ, treating man as a pure or angelic spirit, left out of consideration man's social nature and did not institute a visible supernatural society to draw his members into personal union with him and guide them in living his life, in which, by sanctifying grace, they really share. True religion is both interior and exterior, social and personal, respectful of freedom, and devoted to the authority of the mystical body, dogmatic and moral. These affirmations are complementary, and all are required. What does the Church condemn in that pantheism of which we have so frequently spoken in the preceding chapters? Is it the affirmation of the divine immensity or of the universality of the divine presence in all creatures? No. For that is the Church's own teaching. What she condemns is the limitation, restriction, and imprisonment of the divine immensity and of the divine universality in the narrow limits of the finite and the created. What she condemns is the humanity God, the nature God, that is to say, the diminutions and negations of the divine transcendency, which are at the same time negations of the true reality of nature and of humanity. To mix up and confuse things is to destroy them. God is immanent to all creatures by his essence, his presence, and his power, but he is, at the same time, infinitely transcendent. The divine immanence and the divine transcendence are two great truths which must be clearly grasped and firmly retained. They are purified and corrupted together. To the objection that God, being above all things, cannot be in all things, St. Thomas replies that God is above all things by the excellence of his nature, but in all things as the cause of their being, which is that which is most intimate and innermost in them. Again, pantheism disfigures the great truth that God is all things in an eminent degree. God is the sublimely infinite perfect transfiguration of all our glories and of all our splendors, beauty, strength, light, springtime, gentleness, poetry. He is not identified with us because we have limits. Rather, the little that we are, all that we are, he is, but in an infinitely higher way. Thus is the affirmation of pantheism surpassed, and its error refuted at the same time. For the best way to refute an error is to make manifest the profound truth it disfigures and fails to grasp in its fullness. There is, in pantheism, another positive idea, that of our divinization. It is true that by divine grace, as St. Peter so strikingly teaches, we are made partakers of the divine nature. But this is done in a way infinitely removed from pantheism.